This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
America has a long history of foreign policy aimed at establishing U.S.-style democracy. From Cuba to Cambodia, Haiti to Afghanistan, the U.S. has sought to rebuild nations on the liberal democratic model. In recent years, democratization has become the primary foreign policy goal for the U.S., pushing all other considerations to the periphery. But democracy imposed upon nations without basic security for citizens and without civil society in place has failed, with disastrous results for America, for the nations it has tried to democratize, and for the world. The current frightening availability of poorly secured nuclear weapons means that an unstable and violent world is more dangerous than ever. Yet America's exclusive focus on democracy has led to instability and violence in Iraq, in Central Asia, and around the world. In his new book, Professor of International Relations at George Washington University, Amitai Etzioni, calls for a complete reorientation of American foreign policy. The book is Security First for a Muscular, Moral Foreign Policy. I'm delighted to welcome to the program Amitai Etzioni. Good afternoon, sir.
Good afternoon. I'm delighted to be with you.
Tell us, what prompted the book? What happened in your career when you made the decision, this is a book that I need to write?
I read so many very well thought out, very well documented statements about what did we do wrong in the past, in Baghdad, before that, in Tehran, during the Carter years, Clinton years, Bush years. But I've been looking for where we go from here, how are we going to turn a new page. And I'm very happy you provided a summary of the situation regarding the great difficulties we have in democratizing the world. And once we accept it, once we come down from fantasies to some reality, the question then is not where we have been, where we go from here. And when I couldn't find any answer, I decided I should try my hand at answering that question.
You call in your book, you call for a realistic approach to international relations. Mm-hmm. And yet it was my understanding that that's exactly what George Bush was doing, or at least that's what his administration said when they first came into power at the beginning of the first term. He said, we are realists, and we are going to take a realist approach to international relations, to American foreign policy, that the Clinton administration has not. They've been unrealistic.
The term realistic is really used in two rather different ways. One, in political science and international theory, they often talked about we should focus on our interest and on our national interest. We should look at hard factors like who has more bombs, who has more Marines, and disregard all those other United Nations international law and what they scoff at as kind of moral niceties. I use the term in the Freudian sense. If Freud talks about the need for a sane person to have a reality testing, which simply means that you should come down out from the clouds, that you should not live in a fantasy world, that you look at the facts on the ground. And the facts on the ground is that, at best, the Bush policy, and not only his, Kennedy also tried to democratize 70 nations. It's just trying to do things which is way beyond our power. And to give a quick illustration, I recently went to a meeting of the neoconservatives, and one of their leaders, Charles Krauthammer, came and scoffed gently at his colleagues and said that this idea of democratizing the whole world, China and Venezuela and such, was maybe a bit excessive. That we should only, he says, democratize the Middle East. There was this notion that we're going to fix Iraq overnight, it's going to flip the Middle East, and 3 weeks later we're going to have a prosperous democracy all over the Middle East. That is so unrealistic that it's damaging. So my argument is we have to start with something much more elementary, and that is, first of all, so people be able to go to work, that their children be able to go to school or play outside, that people be able to go to political meetings, which, of course, you cannot do very often these days in large parts of the world, especially in Iraq and Afghanistan. But let me give you quickly a much more telling example.
Sure, sure.
all the experts who looked at the question, what are the greatest threats which our nation faces? And there's no disagreement for once. From the Pentagon to Harvard, came up with the same conclusion, that it's the combination of terrorists with nuclear weapons who could take out a whole city, not a train or an airplane, but a whole city. Now, where could they get the stuff from? Some they could get from Pakistan, but 90% of the stuff they could get is in Russia. There are 10,000 trunk-sized small nuclear weapons. There are piles and piles of uranium, which they can use to make dirty bombs. So we have a program, informally called the Non-Luger. We paid Russia some money to blend down, neutralize these materials, and lock in those nuclear weapons. That program has not been increased by one penny since 9/11. So we keep going to the Russians, including last week, and say, you should democratize. They're not going to do that. Putin is not going to put himself out of business to please us. But on the other hand, if we would sit down with them and say, look, nuclear threats, you have Chechens. We face the same threat here. Let's triple this program. That would enhance our security. Democratization will come in second, not last. That's why the book is called Security First. I'm all in favor of democratization. It has to come in second.
But you can't create a democracy if the streets aren't safe.
Exactly. When I talk to my Russian colleagues about Putin, they see him as not too strong, but too weak, because outside Moscow, there still is a very violent, corrupt, disorganized society. When you have a situation in which, like they used to have in Moscow not long ago, of daily kidnapping, shooting of bankers, people get thrown out of the train so you can take their suitcases, people focus first and foremost on their safety. All the rest comes second in their mind. So if we care about rebuilding the world, our security, especially from nuclear terrorism, their security, stopping the genocide in Darfur, these are the things that have to come first. All the rest is very worthwhile as a second step.
Professor of International Relations at George Washington University, Amitai Etzioni, is the author of the new book, Security First, for a Muscular, Moral Foreign Policy. Amitai, let me ask you, creating security first oftentimes can perhaps look like democratization. We're talking about soldiers in the streets, are we not?
Not necessarily. I briefly suggested that in the case of Russia, we could have a major step forward if we would just blend down dangerous materials, lock away nuclear weapons. But let's quickly turn to rogue states such as North Korea and Iran. We have been approaching them for the last year and told them very openly, we want regime change. We want them to democratize and give up on their theocracy or communism. Now, to give a quick feel what that means, it's exactly like coming to President Bush and say, first of all, give the White House over to Gore, then go and campaign for gay marriages and abortion, and then we talk to you about the rest. We tell them to put themselves out of business. That's what it means for the mullah or for the tyrant of North Korea to democratize and abolish what they firmly believe in. They believe in their Taliban-like regime or their communist regime. So for them to give up, A, on power, and B, on everything they believe, that is just not a conversation starter. On the other hand, both nations approach the United States because they fear to be attacked, and not without reason, that they want to have a non-aggression treaty, means we promise them not to change the regime from the outside with force, and in return, they are willing to talk to us about scaling back their nuclear programs. I'm not sure they will do that, but that is a possible conversation. They get something from us in security terms. We get something from them. We can talk to them about security. Maybe we can deliver. We surely cannot force democratization on them.
Amitai Etzioni's new book is Security First. You spend a portion of your book looking in depth at the major religions that factor into American foreign policy. Tell us how religion plays into this dilemma.
I really appreciate you asking that question, because maybe my most important finding in Security First, there are about 1.2 billion Muslims. If you go and say, if you are not on our side, if you do not democratize and respect human rights, you are on the other side, you're against us. You, in effect, define the overwhelming majority of Islam, of Muslims, as our enemies. Because outside those few are in Western Europe and the United States, most Muslims, I show in great detail in Bangladesh, in Indonesia, in the large Muslim countries, do not favor equal rights for women, do not favor democracy, do not favor separation of state and church or Islam. But if you ask them, are you against suicide bomber? Are you against terrorism? Are you for safer societies for you and us? The overwhelming majority in all those countries, in all of them, vote with us. So here again, if you slice the pie, the global pie, by only those who favor democracy on our side, you're going to have very slim picking. If you're willing to ally yourself for first round with all those who are post-terrorism, you're going to have, for all kind of reasons, the Indonesians don't want to kill the tourism in Bali. Everybody has their own reasons. But the majority of the Muslims are moderate in the sense that they oppose violence. Even the Palestinians, which many people consider particularly aggrieved group, 73% of the Palestinians oppose terrorism. They voted for Hamas in part because of social services, because it's less corrupt. So any way you look at it, any way you measure it, by any eyewitness, you come to the same conclusion. We should work initially with everybody's on the side of peace. Then we sit down and talk to them about human rights and democracy. The poster child of all this is Libya. Libya did exactly what we need. They give up on the weapons of mass destruction. Not inspecting them. We put them on American cargo ships and cargo planes and carried them away. Is he a nice guy? Is he a Democrat? Very far from it. He's a tyrant. But he met our first requirement. He removed weapons of mass destruction.
I guess the point is you don't have to embrace American liberal values and the American definition of freedom to be someone who opposes violence or wants peace.
Exactly right. And it doesn't mean I don't want to. I, if it would be up to me, you know, I would have every Shia, every Sunni, everybody in the world treat women exactly like equal, not impose laws banning alcoholism, alcohol, sale of alcohol, not insist people grow beard, all these things they do under their concept of religion. You know, they're very similar to our Christian fundamentalists. I know that's not going to win me many friends, but they're also very devout people. They're also not all crazy about women as equals. They surely don't appreciate homosexuals, but they're not, most of them are not violent people. There are very few people who would bomb an abortion clinic. The same thing. You can be a true believer, you can have strong religious commitments, and still abhor violence.
Amitai Etzioni, professor of international relations at George Washington. His new book is Security First. The dilemma in finding common ground then with folks who might not embrace American values but want first to find security and reject violence, the dilemma is that we would work with somebody who his own citizens might not like, somebody who might tell America, I believe in peace, I want security. Look, there's no violence in my country. Saddam Hussein had created order in his country, arguably. Not everybody was happy about it, but at least people could send their kids to school. That would be one dilemma I could see if we follow this through to its logical conclusion, then, that we have citizens around the world who identify America as supporting tyrants.
That's a fair challenge. So when it comes to a guy like Saddam Hussein or what we have now in Sudan, where he gassed and kind of engaged in ethnic cleansing of his own people, or like we saw in Kosovo, there I think their life is directly at stake. I think we have a call, because again we're talking about not necessarily democratization, human rights, but stopping genocide, stopping ethnic cleansing. But if you go, let's say, to Saudi Arabia or to China or to Singapore or to Russia or to Syria or to Egypt, there's scores and scores and scores of countries, Venezuela, in which there are no genuine democracy, no real free election, very limited respect for human rights. At this stage, we just don't begin to have the leverage to democratize them all, or even many of them. So unless somebody really thinks we can send the Marines and our missiles and bombers to scores of countries, we have to accept that as long as they do not engage the kind of things we saw in Kosovo or ethnic cleansing, there are no genocides like in Sudan, for the first round, They will need to work with whoever keeps the country together with some modicum of order, the way we do work with Putin, the way we do deal with China, which is not a democracy by a long shot. Then we can, we're not going to turn off our Voice of America, sending them books, inviting them to Fulbright exchanges. Non-lethal means for democratization surely will continue, but we cannot democratize with the Marines anyhow, so may as well not try.
Amitai Etzioni, he's a professor of international relations at George Washington University. His new book is Security First, for a Muscular, Moral Foreign Policy. Sir, it has truly been an honor. Thank you so much for spending time with us.
I appreciate the excellent question. Thanks for having me.
This interview will be archived in its entirety on the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at cvillepodcast.com.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit cvillepodcast.com for more.